You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. In the second and third hour of our program today, we're going to be getting into Anything Goes Friday, as it were, and I have a special question that I'm going to just throw it out right now, and you can call in an hour or two from now, because we're going to go to Senator Sanders in just a second. As the Atlantic is warmer than it's ever been, global warming, and this superstorm is heading for Washington, D.C., global warming, and Louise and I live on a boat in the Potomac River here, and they just issued an evacuation order for our marina. If you've ever lived on a boat through a hurricane or have any suggestions, I've never done this. So I'd love to hear from you. Anyhow, we will get to that as time goes on. And I'm amazed by how the newspapers are not talking about global climate change here, although they are in Europe with regard to this storm. Anyhow, Senator Bernie Sanders, it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us and in his office in Burlington. Hey, Senator, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us, and thank you again for participating in these national town hall meetings that we have, Brunch with Bernie. Senator, what's on your mind today?
Well, I think what's on my mind is the same thing that's on the mind of tens of millions of Americans, and that is who is going to be the next president of the United States, who is going to control the United States Senate, what's going to happen to the future of this country. You know, Tom, in the midst of this whole campaign, what drives me a little bit nuts is the incredible superficiality of the media in terms of looking at political campaigns just like they were football games or baseball games or basketball games. And the whole issue is, you know, what does Romney need to do to win in Florida, and what does Obama need to do to win in Ohio, and on and on and on, rather than asking questions like, what kind of policies do we need so that the middle class in America can see an improved standard of living and not a continued collapse? What should we be doing in America to provide health care to all of our people in an affordable way? What should we be doing to end this disastrous trade policy, which is causing us the loss of millions and millions of decent-paying jobs? So instead of looking at policy and contrasting what Obama has to say with what Romney has to say, it becomes very much a sporting event, an American Idol event, who perspired and who didn't during the debate, who looked presidential, rather than saying, hey, what the hell do we need to do in order to move this country out of this terrible, terrible recession, which is killing the middle class? And I think when you look at it, this is what the conclusion you reach. I think that it is clear that anyone who remembers what was going on in this country 4 years ago understands that not only were we losing 700,000 jobs a month, that is just an unbelievable number. Not only were people losing their homes and their life savings because of the collapse of the stock market, but we were on the verge not just of an American financial collapse, but of an international financial collapse, which very likely would have driven us into a world depression equivalent to or worse than what we had in the 1930s. And while today we are certainly nowhere near where we want to be, we have made some progress and brought some stability. And I think people have got to understand that. The second thing, I think, that has to be said, and I say that as the longest-serving independent in the history of the United States Congress, is, has Obama done all that he should have done in terms of job creation, in terms of standing up to Republican obstructionism, in terms of taking on Wall Street? And the answer is no. So I think what you got is a whole lot of people out there who are saying, well, you know, I understand that Obama inherited a horrendous situation. On the other hand, you know, I don't think he's done all that he should have done for working families. And I'm kind of thinking maybe I'll vote for Romney. But then you got to look at what Romney is talking about. And when you analyze what Romney is talking about, he doesn't have a 5-point plan to create 12 million jobs. He doesn't have an 80-point plan. It's all bogus. It's all fraud. No serious economist or policy group agrees with his analysis that he can create 12 million jobs. Essentially, what Romney wants to do, and people have got to understand that, is he wants to go back to the Bush economic policies of trickle-down economics. More tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country at a time when the rich are doing phenomenally well, more unfettered free trade at a time in which we have lost millions of good-paying jobs because corporations have outsourced American jobs to China and other low-wage countries, more deregulation. Now, how anybody in their right mind could be talking about more deregulation of Wall Street when it was the recklessness and the greed and illegal behavior on Wall Street that caused this recession because of deregulation is beyond my imagination. So I think the dynamic of this campaign is that people, most people, understand that Obama inherited an economic disaster. I think there is significant dissatisfaction that Obama has not been as strong as he should have been, and therefore some people are looking at Romney as an alternative. But it ain't no alternative. It will only take us back to the exact same policies that got us to where we are today. So I think what we've got to do is work as hard as we can to reelect the president, to make sure the Democrats retain control over the Senate, get as many House seats as possible. But the day after the election, we have got to let this president know that he has got to stand up vigorously for working families. He has got to make it clear we are not going to balance the budget, for example, in a lame duck session or in the beginning part of the new session on the backs of the elderly, the children, the sick, and the poor. We are not going to cut Social Security when Social Security has nothing to do with deficit reduction. Social Security has a significant surplus. There are ways to do deficit reduction that are fair. That means you ask the wealthiest people in this country who are doing phenomenally well, whose effective tax rates are very, very low, to start paying their fair share. We're going to end the absurdity of one-fourth of American corporations who are profitable not paying a nickel in taxes. We're going to deal with this disgrace of tax havens in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and elsewhere, where these corporations and wealthy people stash their money to avoid paying their fair share of taxes. And we're going to deal with Wall Street, finally, and say to these guys, sorry, you can't continue doing business the way you have done, which is run the world's largest gambling casino, rather than investing in the productive economy, those companies that need capital in order to grow and create jobs. So there's a lot to be done. But the answer is not to go back to the Bush philosophy, economic approach and elect Romney. We've got to support the president and then put as much pressure on him as possible to stand with working families.
There's another piece to this, too, isn't there? Senator Chevron, for example, this just the news release just came. This is on the Center for American Progress's Think Progress book. Chevron, the second largest oil company in the U.S., eighth largest in the world, just contributed $2.8 million. Actually, it was in October to the Congressional Leadership Fund. It was just reported, which a super PAC to elect House Republicans. This is the single largest donation from a corporation to any super PAC period that they've been able to find. And this, and the House Republicans voted 109 times to enrich the oil companies.
Of course. I mean, you know, and you got the Koch brothers who have made their $50 billion in fossil fuels, oil and coal, putting huge amounts of money into this. No, you can't turn on cable TV, Tom, without seeing an ad coming from the energy companies. So it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that the energy companies are going to support Republicans and Romney. They are going to do everything that they can to make sure that we don't make the necessary transformation of our energy system away from fossil fuel into energy efficiency and sustainable energies like wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass.
And
the truth of the matter is we can create huge numbers of jobs if we moved in that direction.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders for Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program. You can check out Senator Sanders' website, sanders.senate.gov. Ours is tomhartman.com. And we will be back with your calls for Senator Sanders for the rest of the hour right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls live and unfiltered right after this. Yeah, he's the man, Senator Bernie Sanders. I think of him as America's senator, although having lived in Vermont, I know the Vermonters are very proud that he's their senator. Our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting, taking your calls. Alan in Phoenix, Arizona, you are on the air with Senator Sanders. Thanks for listening to AM.
Yes, Senator Sanders, I was very disturbed watching the Frontline program this week called Climate of Doubt, where they showed how big money has turned scientific research into fiction. And I think every American should be asking themselves the question, what are we if the truth has become our enemy? And that's all I have to say.
Well, Alan, thank you very much. I did not see the program. My wife saw it, and she told me about it. Here is the most important fact I think American people have to understand about the current political process, and I say that as a United States senator who spends a lot of time in Washington. Money dominates the political process in America today, and the more money you have, the more you dominate it. In terms of global warming, we have a situation, and I speak as a member of the Environmental Committee, where 98% of the scientists who have written about climate change believe that global warming is real. It is significantly caused by human activity. It is already wreaking havoc on our planet in terms of droughts, floods, severe weather disturbances, and it will only get worse if we do not address it. And yet you have people in the oil companies, in the fossil fuel industry, spending huge sums of money trying to confuse the American people, trying to suggest that this is not a settled issue, that the scientific community is still in doubt about it. They are not in doubt about it. It is real. And the pity of this whole damn thing is that we know how we can reverse global warming, and in the process of reversing global warming, America could become a leader and create millions of jobs in that process. We are wasting an enormous amount of money. If we move aggressively toward energy efficiency, we can cut greenhouse gas emissions and save people money on their fuel bills. I've seen this all over the state of Vermont. We're doing well. We have to do a lot better, and the country has to do much, much better. Obama did a good job in demanding and successfully bringing about an increase in what we call CAFE standards, whereby the year 2025, automobiles in this country are going to get on average about 55 miles per gallon, save people a huge amount of money on their gas bills, and cut greenhouse gas emissions. We've got to invest in rail. We have to invest in wind, solar, geothermal, biomass. When you do those things, you can cut carbon emissions significantly. You can create millions of jobs. You can make America a leader on what is a planetary problem. It's certainly not only an American issue. We've got to get China off of coal. We've got to work with them. So, Alan, nothing surprises me in Washington. And, of course, fossil fuel industry is spending huge amounts of money to confuse the American people.
Elliot in Mission Viejo, California. Elliot, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes. I work with the League of Women Voters. Crucial question, Senator Sanders. Will overturning Citizens United and then getting money out of politics also have the effect of ending the lies and misinformation ads that influence voters' positions on ballot measures?
Yes. The answer is yes. I think, I have introduced, along with others, an amendment to overturn Citizens United, a constitutional amendment, and I do that with a great deal of caution because I'm not one of those guys that thinks you amend the Constitution every day. But I think you have a situation, a disastrous situation with Citizens United, which does two things. Number one, it allows billionaires, and we have documented at least 23 billionaire families, and I'm sure there are a lot more, who are pouring huge amounts of money into this campaign to elect candidates who are going to protect their interests and not the interests of the average American. But the other thing, Elliot, that this does is it intimidates members of the House and Senate and all public officials all over the country. Because if you are prepared to stand up and vote against Wall Street, against the energy companies, you may think twice about that if you know that that vote will unleash a tsunami of radio and television ads against you. So, Elliot, what Citizens United is about is not only money coming into the presidential election, money coming into the Senate and the House races, it's money coming into the local communities as well. It's money coming into ballot items as well. We have got to overturn Citizens United, but beyond that, in my view, we have got to go forward with public funding of elections. Otherwise, you're going to continue to see big money play much too great a role in the political process.
Jeff, in Colorado Springs, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Bernie.
Hi, Jeff.
I would like you to know that we are lucky to have you, such a man as you, amongst us. And my question is, would it be economically feasible to eliminate the corporate income tax entirely and designate all income as earned income, including dividend distributions, capital gains, deferred interest, and all the other things?
Well, what I think, Jeff, is that you certainly do not have a lower tax rate for dividend incomes or capital gains income. The idea that somebody who is a waiter or a waitress, somebody who is a carpenter, somebody who is a cop or a fireman, having to pay a significantly higher rate on their earned income than somebody who is clipping coupons seems to me to be absolutely wrong. And that's the direction that I would go. Overall, we need to make our tax system simpler. We need to get rid of all of the loopholes that exist, and we need to make it progressive. And that means the more you earn, the higher rates you pay.
There you go. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie National Town Hall meeting here on the Tom Hartman Program. 27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders in just a few moments. Check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov. You can drop into our website at tomhartman.com. Say hi in our live chat room. It's free. We just updated our iPhone and iPad app, by the way, in the App Store.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
If you're looking for our app, which has our daily blog and all kinds of cool stuff on it, it's totally free. You can check it out at the App Store, or you can find it at tomhartman.com.
On Thursday, doesn't even start. It's Friday, I'm in love.
34 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. Well, it's the first hour of Anything Goes Friday, which is Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on, taking your calls. And let's see here. Joyce in Clinton, Iowa. Joyce, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. Gentlemen, thank you for getting me very well educated on what things are going on. I've already voted. Our neighborhood has what we call our talk of the month. We all get together and talk about politics, and I've converted a few.
Good for you, Joyce.
But I have a question now. I've just now turned 65 in September, and as I told my son, I'm Medicare approved. What happens to me if Romney gets in?
Well, two things, Joyce. Let me first say I applaud you and your neighbors for getting together to talk about politics and talk about the issues facing your community and the American people. We need to do that all over the country. So thank you for doing that. Here's the story with regard to Medicare. The Republicans in the House, through the so-called Ryan budget, or Paul Ryan, the vice presidential candidate, passed a budget which ends Medicare as we know it over a 10-year period. So in fairness to them, this would not happen to you immediately, but it would happen to people who were 55 years of age or younger. You would still be in the Medicare that we know. For the younger people, what would happen is Medicare would be transformed into a voucher program. And that means that people would be given, we believe, about an $8,000 check. And with that $8,000 check, they would then go out to private insurance companies to get the best deal that they could. Now, the problem, that would be great if, you know, when you get to be 65 or 70, you're in really good health, that's fine. But for many people who are 65 or 70, they're dealing with some serious health issues. For example, if somebody the age of 70 ends up being diagnosed with cancer and needs to have tens and tens of thousands of dollars in treatment, and they take this $8,000 voucher and they walk into a private insurance company, what do you think that insurance company is going to tell them? The insurance company will say, hey, we're in the business of making money, not losing money. Why would we want to give you a policy which will cost us $50,000 when you're only giving us $8,000? That's a loser. We don't want it. Have a nice day. So that is what these guys have in mind. And the end result would be that for older people, they would be stuck with a much larger health care out-of-pocket cost than is currently the case because of that voucher system. So bottom line is, if they get in, and by the way, if they do get in, I and others will do everything we can to stop that transformation of Medicare. But if it happened, it would apply to people 10 years down the line, not immediately.
Jonathan in Princeton, New Jersey. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. How are you doing, sir? My question was kind of... Hello?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is kind of general. I'm actually not a... This is the first election that I've actually gotten really involved, I guess. It's just listening to both parties and just hearing what's coming out of the Republican Party. It's shocking. And I'm just wondering why people, I guess, are not even paying attention to some of the things. This morning I looked at the map with all the states and the blues and the reds, and I looked at Massachusetts, and I noticed it was blue. And I was thinking to myself, why with all the things that Romney's saying he's done so well in Massachusetts with women's pay equality.
His binders full of women?
Sorry?
With his binders full of women?
Yes, his binders full of women comment, yes. And his health care, how he's done so great with education, all these other things. If he's done such a great job in Massachusetts, why is that state not the reddest state on the map? And that just doesn't make sense to me.
And well, Jonathan, I think that is an excellent point. Romney was the governor of Massachusetts for 4 years, and I guess the people in that state know him pretty well. And the latest polls that I have seen in terms of Massachusetts is that Obama is ahead by 15, 20 points in that state. It appears, we never know what's going to happen, but at this point at least, it appears that Obama will defeat Romney by a landslide. In Romney's own state, where he was governor. And I think probably, I don't want to speak for the people of Massachusetts, but I think that one thing that may be going on is the people see in Romney somebody who really does not have firm convictions about very much, that he is, as a staffer some months ago described, kind of an etch-a-sketch candidate, that he will, when he's running against right-wing Republicans in the primary, he's a right-winger. When he's running in the presidential election trying to appeal to women, he's suddenly a moderate. Years ago, he had different views on abortion than he has right now. Years ago, he had different views on this, that, and the other thing than he has right now. And I think the people in Massachusetts may, I don't want to speak for them, have the sense that this is a guy who goes with the wind, who changes his views to accommodate the political moment, and is not somebody they feel very comfortable with. And here's the major irony, that probably some in Massachusetts would say that his major accomplishment was the health care bill that he worked on with the Democrats to pass. And then you have President Obama kind of bringing forth national legislation emulating what Romney did in Massachusetts, and Romney wants to repeal it because his right-wing base wants that to happen. So I think maybe the folks in Massachusetts understand something that not all Americans do, that there's a lot of hypocrisy in Mr. Romney's candidacy.
Greg in Troy, Michigan, you are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator and Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I heard you talking about moving away from our dependency on fossil fuels. I'm totally in agreement with that. But I also share concerns with a lot of people about our dependency on nuclear power. And using Fukushima as a reference, I think it's just a matter of time if we don't do something before something similar happens here. Just as an example, we have this huge storm coming up the East Coast, and I realize that's probably not going to cause a problem, but something worse could happen. There's always earthquakes, and I would really like to see us move away from nuclear before anything really serious happens, potentially killing millions of people and destroying the environment for centuries. And I just wonder if the senator has an opinion on that, and wouldn't that also, if we started doing that, wouldn't that also spur job creativity?
It sure would, Greg. And I share your your concerns. It's not my view that you can shut down all of the nuclear power plants in America today. You can't do that. But I think what we can do is start phasing them out over a period of time and moving this country very aggressively toward energy efficiency and sustainable energy. I think people are not aware that right now in America we are seeing the creation of solar utilities projects with through solar energy are going to provide electricity to hundreds of thousands of homes. We're moving aggressively with photovoltaics, and the price of those have gone down very considerably. We're moving in terms of what's called concentrated solar technology, which uses mirrors to run turbines to generate electricity. And we're making progress there as well. So I think, you know, if we really wanted to devote ourselves to what you might want to call a Marshall Plan, whatever you want to call it, to saying that in X number of years, through energy efficiency and movement to solar, wind, geothermal, could we generate the electricity that we need in this country to maintain strong economic growth while moving away from fossil fuel and over a period of years nuclear? I believe that we can. And I think Greg's point that when we do that, we are going to create millions of good-paying jobs, especially if we are producing those products, the solar panels and the wind turbines and the energy efficiency products of insulation and wind and doors and roofing here in the United States of America. So that is my vision for the transformation of our energy system. The other point that I would make on nuclear is, Greg, it's not only the potential danger of nuclear vis-a-vis Fukushima. It is also the high cost of nuclear power. If you want to know the most expensive way forward to generate electricity now, it is new nuclear. So I think if we invest in energy efficiency, sustainable energies, we can have a safe and bright energy future and one that allows us to create millions of good-paying jobs.
Susan, in Leoma, Tennessee, we have a minute to the break. Susan, a quick question?
Thank you. Although I have heard Romney actually say Trans-Pacific Partnership, I didn't hear Obama say it, but I heard him infer it. How are we going to stop Obama from signing that Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement?
Well, Susan, you've touched on a very, very important point, and it's one of the reasons why there is a disappointment among many people with the president. Certainly, we hear every day from Romney how wonderful unfettered free trade is. And I should think that he knows a lot about it because Bain Capital has been one of those folks, one of those companies that has worked to shut down companies in America and move them to China. So he knows a lot about unfettered free trade and how advantageous it is for him and his friends to shut down plants in America and move abroad. But the president has not been strong on this issue. There's no question in my mind. And some of us are doing what we can to say, wait a minute, we've got to rethink our trade policies, including the Trans-Pacific program.
We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Bernie Sanders right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Don't touch that dial. Senator Bernie Sanders back with you in our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie, in just a moment.
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. I am just about to be brilliant.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just a quick heads up. At some point during the day, one of our callers, Shano, our associate producer here in his infinite caprice, is going to pick out a caller to win an autographed copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision by Tom Hartman. And it's a book on political messaging that I wrote. Jim Hightower wrote the foreword to it. So back to Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us, taking your calls. And Mike in Detroit, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I appreciate you taking my call and coming on to Tom's program to speak to callers. My question is, did you ask Tom to screen out tough questions? Because that's what his staff does.
Okay. No, he didn't. I'll answer for the senator because he has never asked me to screen out any questions. Gregory, in Woodcliff Lake, New Jersey, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. And Bernie, it's an honor talking to you right now. I just actually got off reading Outsider in the House, great book. And I wanted to ask you, what's your opinion on Mitt Romney's proposal to privatize Amtrak? What would be the effects of that?
Oh, that would be a disaster. Amtrak now, Gregory, as it happens, is doing very, very well. I mean, I think what ends up happening when our friends at the ExxonMobil and the other big oil companies are ripping off the American people to the tune of, you know, $3.90 or $4 for a gallon of gas, people suddenly begin to look at trains. And we have put, through the stimulus package, a significant amount of money into improving our rail service. We had a long, long, long way to go. Europe, Japan, China are now ahead of us in terms of high-speed rail. In Vermont, we've just made some significant improvements to our rail line. But, no, I am strongly opposed to the privatization of Amtrak. I think we have to support Amtrak. Amtrak and rail, both for passengers and cargo, by the way, is one way that we can significantly address greenhouse gas emissions, keep trucks off the roads, cars off the road. We have to do a lot better in improving our rail system. We have to invest in it and create jobs doing that, certainly not privatize it.
Ann in Vancouver, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, did you say Ann?
Yes, you were on the air.
Great. Okay, I just have a quick question. Is there any way we can control the filibuster, either by making them actually filibuster or maybe by limiting the number of filibusters that they can have so we won't get these ridiculous numbers?
And that is a great question, and it's an important question. I was just talking to the Majority Leader, Harry Reid, the other day, and we were talking about this issue. And he mentioned to me that when Lyndon Johnson, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, when Lyndon Johnson was Majority Leader, I think for 6 years in the 50s.
Yes, it was. He told me that same story in Las Vegas 2 weeks ago.
And what, there was something like, under Lyndon Johnson for 6 years, there was one filibuster.
That's right.
Under Harry Reid in the last 6 years, with Republicans going nuts on the filibuster, there have been hundreds.
Yeah, it's been over 370, as I recall.
Was that what you said, 370?
I think it was 378 or 387 or something, somewhere in that neighborhood. Yeah.
So what you got, Ann, is the Republicans have abused the system very clearly. Mitch McConnell a couple of years ago made it very clear what he said publicly. He didn't hide it. Our major priority is to make sure that Barack Obama is a one-term president. And that was not just idle chatter. That was part of an effort to obstruct in a way that is unprecedented in American history, so that virtually every significant piece of legislation requires now 60 votes rather than 50 votes, and to use other parliamentary tactics in order to prevent action from taking place and legislation from being passed. So, and you're right on. It's a wonderful question, and it is something that has to be addressed. And I am working with senators like Tom Udall, with Jeff Merkley in Oregon and others to make sure that, yes, we have to protect minority rights in the Senate, but we cannot let the Senate, in fact, dominate what goes on. We do believe in majority rule. So I believe we do need strong filibuster reform, and we're looking at different approaches.
Al, in Rome, Wisconsin, you're on the air with Senator Sanders. Al?
Yeah, hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Okay, Senator, what would it take to get every vet plastic card so they can go where they want?
Well, I don't know that I agree with that, Al. I'm a member of the Veterans Committee. What I think we want to do is to strengthen the VA right now, which provides very good quality health care. And I think we want to expand the number of what we call CBOX, community-based outreach clinics, so veterans all over the country have access to primary health care in their own communities rather than having to travel long distances to a VA medical center. I think if you simply voucherized it, which is kind of what you're talking about, it would be a very, very expensive proposition. On the other hand, I think there may be times when if veterans can't get their health care locally or get the kind of care they need,
that would be fine. But in general, my belief is that we have to strengthen the VA, which is a very good system, and B, a very cost-effective system.
Bernie, we have just 1 minute till the end of the hour. Your thoughts on this point in time and where we need to be what we need to be thinking about and doing?
Well, I think everybody is, you know, kind of focused on the election right now. I always find disturbing is that when they do polls and they say, you know, the likely voters as opposed to registered voters. Well, if you just look at registered voters, I think in most of these polls, Obama wins and sometimes by a good vote. If you look at likely voters, some of the polls have Romney ahead. And what that means is that there are a lot of folks out there who, you know, are inclined to vote for Obama, but are not quite sure they want to make this big, difficult effort to go to the polling booth on election day or vote early. Well, you know what? This is called the United States of America. People have fought and died to make sure that it is the people who run this country, not a king or a queen. And I don't think voting is such a difficult task. So I think that people have a patriotic duty, a democratic responsibility on election day to go out and vote. Let's make sure that our government starts working for all of the people, not just a handful of people on top.
Bernie, thanks again for bringing your brilliance and your passion to our program every week. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tom. Take care.
It's an honor to have you. And check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So the storm assign, what's the Frankenstein metaphor that they're making for this? Frankenstorm, that's it. Frankenstorm is on its way here to the East Coast. Holy cow, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. It's on its way here to the East Coast, and nobody's sure where it's going to hit, but they're pretty sure it's going to hit here in Washington, D.C., and we're living on this 30-year-old boat in the marina out here and tying it down like crazy and all that. But if you've ever been through a hurricane on a boat, let me know. I'm curious if you have any advice. But beyond that, I think we're going to be sleeping in the studio here with the cats. It just doesn't seem like a good idea. Beyond that, there is a lot going on. This is Joshua Holland. I love Joshua Holland. He wrote this brilliant piece for Alternate. 10 big surprises in store for Tea Partiers fleeing to Canada if Obama wins. Starts out with a bunch of tweets. Palmer Price tweeting, if Obama wins this election, who wants to throw in some gas money and hitch a ride with me to Canada? All right, they've got their own hashtag. Any takers? Riley McAndrews, I think if Obama wins, my dad will make us move to Canada. Mason Jones, if Obama wins the election, I can promise you I'm moving to Canada. Really? So the right-wingers want to move to Canada. Well, one of the things, you know, there's some things that's really going to surprise these Tea Partiers. As Joshua Holland points out, Canadians don't enjoy their freedom to work their butts off and be poor. No, they actually have a minimum wage of $9.90 an hour. I mean, ours is $7.25 an hour. And even crazier, they've got legislation right now to make it $13 an hour, a living wage. They're having a discussion about it. And unemployment? Well, their unemployment is about 1.5% point, 1.5 points lower than ours. The Econopolis, right. Not so much better. Jean Poutine is not the prime minister. One of those rascally Canucks had some fun at the expense of George W. Bush asking him on the campaign trail if he appreciated getting the endorsement of Prime Minister Jean Poutine. That's actually French fries, cheese curds, and gravy. Yeah, seriously. Canada sucks at projecting power. If you're a Tea Partier and you want to be an empire, a worldwide empire, sorry, Canada is not the guy. I mean, Stephen Harper is the prime minister, and he is white and evangelical Christian, kind of like George W. Bush, but, you know, they only spent $25 billion on their military. That's less than, you know, we spent on the Department of Homeland Security. Brazil spends more on its military than the Canadians do. Plus, you know, they had 150 soldiers get killed in Afghanistan, five of them by American fire, and Harper, the prime minister, decided, okay, that's it, we're out, and they're out now. They've withdrawn. Another thing you should remember, if you're a Tea Party or thinking of moving to Canada, they do speak French there, as Joshua Holland points out. Pam Geller is illegal in Canada. Seriously. The head of the birther movement? Hate speech laws in Canada include provisions in the Criminal Code and the Human Rights Act and statutory provisions in each of Canada's 10 provinces and 3 territories. The Criminal Code prohibits hate propaganda. Canadian Human Rights Act prohibits discrimination on various grounds and forbids the posting of hateful or contemptuous messages on the Internet. Feel the liberty? All right. They can't shoot straight. Americans are 15 times more likely to use handguns to kill each other than Canadians. Seriously, as Joshua Holland says, Canadians are just un-American. He says Celine Dion is a superstar up there, enough said. You can work and raise a family just like in communist China. Really? And I find that very entertaining. Silvio Berlusconi, well, we'll do this as a Berlusconi alert a little later on. I love our Berlusconi alert. And this Frankenstorm barreling toward the East Coast, Think Progress has this very, very interesting. There's a major newspaper coverage of Frankenstorm Sandy. Almost 100 newspapers, major stories, as in front page stories, is that's how many newspapers have covered that story. The mentions of climate change or global warming, guess how many? 6? 12? 9? Almost 100? National? I mean, this is a big story, right? How many major newspapers have mentioned global warming? Keep in mind, the reason why this storm is coming in a way that has never basically happened before is because the Atlantic is so much warmer than it used to be. Number of newspaper stories that have mentioned global warming, 0. So, there you go. It is pretty amazing. Jonathan in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Jonathan, what's on your mind?
Hey, we have the marriage amendment here in Minnesota, and the big ads against it are saying that you can't vote to allow gay people to get married because then they'll start teaching it in schools, and we don't want to deal with the gay lifestyle. But on the other side, though, Republican candidates are downplaying rape, and they're saying that it's a gift from God. And
well, not the rape itself, the pregnancy that results from it, but, you know.
Yeah. Right, and I'm thinking, though, that wouldn't that kind of empower the rapists to think that, I mean, they're you got to be a little twisted in the head to want to do something like that. So don't, wouldn't they feel like they're doing God's work? I mean, if it's a gift from God, they're just helping out God. So I think you're getting some crazy people even more power.
Yeah, it's an interesting theory, Jonathan. I think more. You know, I'm not going to go down that road. I don't disagree totally with your perspective, but I think the point that really needs to be made is that at its core, all these men talking so casually about rape and trying to decide. If somebody's been legitimately raped or forcibly raped was the language that Paul Ryan voted in favor of in the legislation that was in the House of Representatives. Paul Ryan is running for vice president of the United States right now. The legislation that's before the state of Pennsylvania, this is pretty mind-boggling. Pennsylvania bill would reduce welfare benefits for women who cannot prove they were raped. Right? If you're a single mom and you can't prove that that baby was the result of rape, even if it was, they want to cut your TANF, T-A-N-F, assistance. Not sure what that's an acronym for. I think that's food stamps, isn't it? I used to know all these acronyms, but this is a new one, or a relatively new one on it. But in any case, temporary assistance for needy families. Thank you, Shano. Eliminate a benefit. This is... They're going to slash welfare benefits unless you can prove that you report that a woman reported sexual assault and her abuser's identity to the police. I've got the law right here. Elimination of benefits under subsection D shall not apply to any child conceived as a result of rape or incest, providing that the department receives a non-notarized signed statement from the pregnant woman stating that she was the victim of rape or incest, as the case may be, and that she reported the crime, including the identity of the offender, if known, to a law enforcement agency having the requisite jurisdiction. Right. So it's not just about limiting the right to have the morning after pill if you get raped. It's also about limiting it. This is literally the war on women. This is misogyny on parade. We're seeing in the Republican Party right now racism on parade. Yesterday, John Sununu coming out after Colin Powell endorsed President Obama and basically saying, oh, yeah, of course, he's a black guy. He's going to endorse the black guy. Right. John Sununu is a white guy. Is that why he's endorsing Mitt Romney? Nobody asked him that question. It would have been a good follow-up. But, you know, not only do you have racism on parade, but we have misogyny on parade in the Republican Party right now. And I think Americans are starting to wake up to this, Frank.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I love it, by the way. Yesterday, Barack Obama, in this interview with Douglas Brinkley of Rolling Stone, said, Ayn Rand, yeah, teenagers read that stuff.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now heaven knows, anything goes.
Anything goes Friday. Any topic you want to talk about, give us a shout. It's the one day of the week when we just basically, you know, anything you want. Cindy in Naperville, Illinois. Hey, Cindy, what's on your mind?
Well, I was wondering if anything is being looked into regarding the voting, the Romney's interest in the voting machines in Ohio.
Well, you know, there's some publicity about it. One of the Romney sons is an investor or an owner in an investment company that owns stock in a company that owns one of the voting machine companies. I don't see that as the Romney family controlling the vote, frankly. I see that as a symptom of a much larger problem. That doesn't have to do with voter fraud, but has to do with the privatization of the commons. The most important of our commons is not the Grand Canyon. It's not the Brooklyn Bridge. It's not our roads. It's not our, you know, publicly owned electric systems and water systems. It's not our education systems. It's not our Army or our Navy or our Air Force. Those are all part of the commons. But the most important part of the commons is the method by which we administer all those other commons. And that is by electing people to office who represent the views that we, the people, hold. That's the linchpin, the cornerstone of American democracy. And to have privatized the vote by giving the vote over to private for-profit corporations is, in my opinion, including corporations owned in part by one of Mitt Romney's sons, is, in my opinion, a horrible crime. But the idea that Mitt Romney's son would buy into Hart Inner Civic or invest in Hart Inner Civic so that he could manipulate the vote, I think is a stretch that it ain't going to happen. It would just be too obvious. It's just because thank you for the call, Cindy. The problem is this Help America Vote Act. I mean, there's all this money, federal money, to local and county and state municipalities to buy voting machines, and you know they get addicted to this stuff. And it shouldn't be. We should do like Canada has done. We should do, you know, Ireland tried electronic voting machines. They sold them. This is 3 months ago. We did the story here on this program. They're selling them for scrap metal right now. I mean, basically, you know, put them on eBay as scrap metal. Don't even sell them as voting machines. You don't want anybody using them that way. They don't work. They're not reliable. Kelly in Oak Creek, Wisconsin. Hey, Kelly, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just had a question. I'm not so sure how familiar you are with railroad retirement, but I'm a locomotive engineer, and we're finding out that under the Ryan Romney plan, they want to attack our Tier 1.
So they want to reduce your retirement benefits if you work for the railroad.
Yeah, they want to tap into it. Yeah, we don't pay into Social Security. We have our own.
Is that through Amtrak, you mean, Amtrak employees?
No, actually, no, I'm through a freight company.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, I am not familiar with that. I'm sorry.
Social Security was based on railroad retirement. We're completely solvent, and you know it's completely solvent.
Mm-hmm.
And under Ryan, we're finding out that he wants to tap into it, and isn't that kind of theft? I mean,
yeah.
Isn't there any way? that should be illegal, isn't it?
Well, you know, what Ryan and his budgets and what the Republicans want to do is anywhere where government is being successful, anywhere where there's a program that is administered by the government with very low overhead and very high competency, whether it's Social Security or the Railroad Retirement Fund or, you know, I mean, you name it. If there's money there that they can transfer into the hands of their buddies on Wall Street who fund them to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars when it comes election time and who lobby for them and with them and buy them, you know, $400 dinners and all this kind of stuff, anything that they can do to make that happen, they're going to do to make that happen. And yeah, I think it's criminal. Kelly, thanks for the call. I think it's even beyond criminal. It's wrong. Bill in Clifton, New Jersey. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. May I first give you a quick suggestion about Monday?
Certainly.
It's just what I think you should do is set up a webcam in your boat, get a hotel room, and have a romantic evening.
Oh, that's interesting.
And
see what it looks like. I have a feeling it's going to be pitching around like crazy. I mean, it's there's a hurricane coming. We just got a notice from the marina saying, do not try to ride out a hurricane in your boat. Crazy people do that and they die. And this marina was built in the 1970s, which is about just a little before our boat was built.
Tom?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to hear from you again.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Go somewhere.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Shane and Danielle have an air mattress and some sleeping bags that we're bringing into the studio here. And Louise and I and the cats are probably going to be sleeping here in the studio. So.
Well, you could sit up telling ghost stories. Anyway.
There you go. On the area.
About Mitt Romney, as far as I know, he's got security clearance, him and Ryan, for the past few months. My question is, what do they know about what happened in Libya, and when do they know it, and are they illegally exploiting it for political gain?
Well, they're certainly exploiting it for political gain. There's no doubt about that. And I mean, when Geraldo Rivera on Fox News comes out and says, stop exploiting Libya for political gain to the Romneyites or to Fox, you know that they've jumped the shark. But, you know, what do they know and when do they know it? Bill, you're absolutely right. Mitt Romney, as a presidential candidate, is getting the same security briefings or a very, you know, abbreviated version of the same security briefings that the President of the United States is getting. And so he is politicizing intelligence, and I do think that that's, akin to treason, frankly. David in Whitethorn, California. A minute to the break, David. What's up?
Yeah, Tom, I just have a quick comment here. When Romney was a Green in the debate the other night with Obama's surge and the withdrawal from Afghanistan, I think Obama should have just looked right in the camera and said, I'm President Barack Obama, and I approve this message. And then one other thing, I think the Republicans ought to change their name to Republicans.
Yeah, it seems to be something that a startling number of them are very seriously thinking about a lot of the time. The other thing that a lot of these Republican men think about a lot of the time is gay men. And so you just, you know, as Romney said, you know, where your money is, there is your heart also. And, of course, his money is in the Cayman Islands and Switzerland. But, you know, what you think about all day long is basically what you become or what you are. So, David, thank you for the call. Funny comment. Good one. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Friday. By the way, at the top of the next hour, former Governor Kathleen Sebelius is going to drop by. She is now the Secretary of Health and Human Services. It should be an interesting conversation, administering the programs that basically are social safety net. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one of my favorite books that I've ever written, Cracking the Code, is going to be given away today by when Shano picks out a caller for us. It is a brilliant book. It's Friday. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. And Charles in Indian Trail, North Carolina. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Oh, I just thought I'd let you know I've been through a few hurricanes and a couple of typhoons, and thought I'd tell you with your boat what you need to do is just make sure you have lots of bumper things so it doesn't rub against the dock.
Okay. All right. We have three bumpers out right now. And I think I have another two on board, so I'll put those out.
You may want to break those out too. The other thing is if you've got it tied down tight, you're going to lose your boat. you got to have lots of extra slack to take care of the tidal surge.
Ah,
so the water is going to go up on the Potomac River.
Right, but the dock we're on is a floating dock.
Okay, that helps a little bit, but you still want to have a little extra space for it.
Right, okay, so loosen the lines so that there's some give in them.
Yeah.
Yeah,
the other thing is, have you seen the movie, the newer movie of Clash of the Titans?
No.
Okay, well, if you ever get a chance to look at that, I want you to notice that the Kraken has an awful close appearance to Mitch McConnell.
Okay. I always thought Mitch McConnell looked like a turtle.
But...
Okay, thanks for the advice, Charles. I appreciate that. And thanks for calling in. And, I should have asked. Well, in any case, Joey. Joey in Springfield, Missouri. Hey, what's up, Joey?
Hey, Tom. Just a terrific show. I learned so much from you.
Thank you.
You know, it's like I've learned how the, you know, job creators are really job profiteers because they don't hire anybody. They're not going to make profit off of them. You know, that would be charity. And then pro-life, who isn't pro-life?
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
In fact, the original pro-life movement for decades, arguably a century, was the anti-death penalty movement. It was called the pro-life movement. That name got co-opted by the anti-abortion movement in the early 1980s.
Yeah, I guess we got Luntz to thank for that. But the reason I called is because I wanted to say this thing about God's will. You know, I had my wife and I had a full-term stillborn child. It died the day it was born.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It never did breathe in air. It got tangled up in a cord. But, you know, you think about, was that God's will? You know, I can't look at it that way. You know, who cannot do God's will? So it must either all be God's will or none of it is.
Yeah.
You know, that's just kind of the way I look at it. And, you know, to quit thinking of God as a person, but more as God is not a being, God is being. You know, and that way I could live with the fact that it was not God's will that my child was stillborn.
Yeah, the kind of God that you're describing is the one that Thomas Jefferson believed in. The deists believed that there was some sort of animating intelligence that brought forth the universe and that established, not necessarily even intellectually, but just, you know, the laws of physics, that there are basic laws that everything operates under, and everything has just been going ever since then. And that, you know, that's it. I mean, in fact, Jefferson went through the New Testament and with a razor blade and cut out all of the miracles and assembled it back together with Jesus as a prophet rather than as a miraculous being and put it into print as the Jefferson Bible. And it's still in print. You can buy it in bookstores right now. I mean, it's been in print for 200 years.
Yeah.
So,
I learned so much from your show. Also, did you see a DU where they're saying that the NSA retired agent saying that they're stealing 10% of the vote nationwide from big precincts? They've got all the facts and figures and figured out how they're doing it with these voting machines. When are we ever going to get our vote back?
Yeah. Well, we're going to get our vote back when the Republican voters start thinking that Democrats have hijacked the voting machines. That's the trick. What we need to do is, if it came out that Anonymous had hacked a voting machine in a way that was really conspicuous, like people walk into the voting booth and they push the button for Mitt Romney and all of a sudden the voting machine starts singing happy birthday to you or, you know, something like that. I'm not joking. This is actually when I believe it was the University of Michigan, had this competition a couple of years ago. In fact, it was 4 years ago. I think it was the last election or even before that, where they said, okay, here's a voting machine. If you can hack into this voting machine, you can win a prize and all this kind of stuff. And the students who hacked into it remotely, I mean, they didn't, you know, they believed it was unhackable. The students who hacked into it had it sing a song. In fact, it was the U of M fight song. And so might have been the University of Pennsylvania, whatever it was. So, anyhow, Amy in Lombard, Illinois. Hey, Amy, what's on your mind? Amy? Amy, you are on the air.
Hey, Tom.
Yeah. What's up?
Oh, sorry about that. This is Amy. I'm executive director of the Democrats in DuPage. You came out and talked to our gala.
Yes.
And we thank you very much. We found out something interesting about early voting here. And that is that it's giving people the opportunity to find out that they've been taken out of the system. So if there's a silver lining here in Illinois, and I don't know how many other states offer grace period voting where you can register and vote at the same time.
Right.
here most in states Illinois, don't. They do.
Yeah, I think there's only either 7 or 9 states where you can register to vote on the day of voting.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yes, exactly. This is just up until November the 3rd. But if you go to early vote, you can find out whether you're in the system. You don't have to stay and vote. You could actually leave if you're not in the, or if you're in the system and you want to wait till election day, that's fine.
Right.
If you're not in the system, you have a week to correct that problem and go vote on a paper ballot. So I just wanted to mention that as a silver lining.
Are you discovering, Amy, as the executive director of the Democratic Party at DuPage County, are you discovering that when people show up to vote in predominantly Democratic neighborhoods or minority neighborhoods, that they are being disproportionately discovering that they've been removed from the voting rolls, or has that not happened?
You know, the self-report isn't really great, and one of the problems we have out here is that our motor voter is very inconsistent. You know, even though, you know, the Secretary of State is actually a Democrat, we had a couple today that came in, and they had registered with motor voter together. He was in the system, but she was not.
Hmm.
We've had a lot of problems with motor voter. It's a very, very inefficient system here,
yeah.
But without a full report, not everybody who gets kicked out calls us on the phone and says we weren't able to vote.
Right.
I can make a comment on the disproportionality of it.
Sure. You wanted to make a comment?
I don't think I can comment on the
disproportionality
of it.
Thank
you. I'm sorry.
You know,
have a lot of reports.
We have reached the point. I remember, you know, years ago, it used to be illegal to use your Social Security number for ID or for any company to ask for it for ID. Now it's routinely used for ID. Why don't we simply set up a system where when somebody's issued a Social Security number, which increasingly is at birth, they are immediately registered to vote for the rest of their life?
I think that would be junior.
I mean, it just seems like a simple program.
Back a movement for that.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Amy, thanks.
And also the people who become citizens need to automatically be put into that plan.
Sure. Well, as soon as those people become citizens, they apply for Social Security cards. So, bingo, there you
right.
go.
Good point.
So, you know, it seems to me like, and then, you know, photo ID and all this other, you know, all this, you know, all this voter suppression thing. Here's my Social Security card. This is me, you know, and here's my utility bill or whatever that proves that I live where I live. Amy, thank you very much for the call and for the heads up. Early voting is, this is really important. Early voting is an opportunity to get in there. Kai in Forreston, Illinois. Hey, Kai, what's up?
Yeah, hey, Tom. Got a question for you here, and I'm hoping you'll know the answer. I have a Republican history teacher that I got into a little dialogue with who believes that this whole rape baby, gotta keep it thing with the Republicans going on right now, that because unions are 501c3 and don't pay taxes at all, and churches don't pay taxes at all, and that unions can petition and lobby the government.
They can.
Churches should also be allowed to. So can you clarify any of those? Because some of that seems like it's not
yeah.
factual.
Yeah. It, you know, unions did not have the right to lobby the government, or did not have the right to participate in governance, lobby the government, whatever it may be. And in 1935, when the Wagner Act came along, I believe that they got that right. I may be wrong on that. And then in 1947, Taft-Hartley might have tried to take it away. I frankly don't recall the specific history of that. With regard to churches, it's a whole different thing. That was in the 60s. Lyndon Johnson cut a deal with the religious leaders where he said, we will give you tax-exempt status if you will stay out of politics. That, you know, churches and politics should not mix. And at that time, there were substantial limitations on union activities that I think came out of Taft-Hartley, particularly political activities. And basically what happened was Citizens United blew all that up. So now unions can engage in political activity, corporations can engage in political activity, churches, well, maybe, maybe not. And you're right, there's a certain level of kind of disconnect there, although the purpose of a union and the purpose of a church are arguably very, very different. I think that we need to reevaluate, you know, the whole tax code thing. You know, why are we providing nonprofit status to anybody? At some point, you have to ask the question, why do we do this? You do it because there's some greater good involved. That organization actually is doing something of value. So, you know, if somebody is running a community for abused kids, yeah, I think they should be tax exempt. If somebody's running a library, I think they should be tax exempt. Charitable organizations, educational organizations. But Karl Rove, with his GPS, you know, as a nonprofit charitable organization, I got a problem with that. And whether unions or corporations should be able to say money is speech and we are persons, I'm frankly opposed to both of them being in that position. I think that it will actually work to the benefit of the unions because they don't so much speak with a corporate voice like corporations do. But that's a more subtle point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Yeah, on the other hand, let's make all insurance companies require them to be not-for-profit organizations like used to be in the United States. Rock you like a hurricane. Oh, man, I am not looking forward to this. Welcome back to Talk Media for the Sane Among Us. This Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the efforts of Free America's newest political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. Victoria Jones on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Well, hey, Tom, and there's every reason not to look forward to this. Hurricane Sandy is on a 90% certainty course of collision
with D.C.,
Atlantic, and the Northeast.
We've got friends tying down our boat right now.
which
is our home.
Very, very smart.
Yeah.
Forecast models clustering on a landfall between the Delmarva Peninsula and Cape Cod. The most recent track that I looked at had it 8 o'clock on the 30th in the morning, basically right over Washington, D.C.
Wow. So 8 o'clock Monday morning?
8 o'clock Tuesday morning.
Tuesday morning.
8 o'clock Tuesday morning, the 30th,
so
right over Washington, D.C. So it's a very slow-moving storm. That's one of the reasons why this is being called the Frankenstorm, because you've got the hurricane, you've got the storm coming from the west, and you've got this Arctic blast of air coming from the north. Then you've got the Hunter's full moon, making sure that these flood tides are higher than usual, and you're going to have several of them because it's going through a course of several days. They say that this could be a storm lasting 4 or 5 days.
Wow. Now, Victoria, one of the things the Center for American Progress has pointed out is that out of the many, many stories in newspapers all over the country, major newspapers in all over the country that talk about this storm, the number of mentions of global warming having something to do with this weather weirding that we're experiencing is zero.
Yes. Now, interestingly, there was mention of this, of climate change, at the very beginning of this storm breaking. I noticed this because I'm storm obsessed, having had some bad power outage experiences with Pepco.
Uh-huh.
And round about Tuesday or Wednesday, there was mention of climate change and why climate change hadn't come up, and maybe this storm would cause climate change to be a topic among the candidates. And then it went away. And then the focus was on the storm as though that was peripheral.
Wow.
And not relevant. Now, whether this particular storm has anything to do with climate change, I don't know.
Right.
But it's interesting that it was there for a blink.
Yeah.
And then it went away again.
Well, I one of the things that I have seen, I'm sort of storm obsessed right now because this thing might take out my house. And
right. I'm in a basement, so.
Yeah, and so I, you know, was watching last night, 3 o'clock in the morning. I couldn't sleep. At 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm watching Weather Channel videos or weather.com videos. And the guy is talking about how the Atlantic Ocean is unusually warm. It's warmer than it has been in centuries. And, of course, this is the answer, by the way, to the question, where did all that carbon dioxide go? And where did all that heat go? Because one of the things over the last decade or so, many of the global climate change deniers who come on this show to argue with me have said is, Well, according to your models, the atmosphere should be a lot warmer than it is. Where'd all the heat go? And there should be more carbon dioxide than there is. Where did it all go? Turns out it went into the ocean. The ocean has been absorbing CO2 and it's been absorbing heat. And so, you know, this reporter simply said, you know, the Atlantic is unnaturally warm, unseasonably warm, unusually warm, and therefore that's feeding the storm. Now, if that's not global climate change, I don't know what is. I mean, what, you think somebody, you know, took an electric toaster and tossed it in the Atlantic off the coast of Hatteras or something and just, you know, warmed it all up? I mean, you know, how did it get warm?
Anyway. Good question. I think you answered it.
Oh, that's it. Yeah, okay. Some guy with a toaster. Okay, so what else?
It was toaster and all those fried fish. That's
yes.
Well, the other piece of this, of course, is the political piece that I talked about in my email this morning, which is how is this going to impact the election? And the answer is we don't know, but there are many ways that it could. One, of course, is early voting.
Right.
Will it cause people to focus and go out and vote this weekend? Well, maybe the high information voter, but maybe not others. Others who might have been thinking about going next week might not go at all.
Particularly swing state Virginia, which is going to get
exactly.
hit by this thing.
Exactly. Particularly low information voters, as they're known. Particularly less enthused voters who might have been galvanized to go, but now might be dealing with storm drains or wreckage in the street.
Now, who does that work to the benefit of? It seems to me like if you're a low information voter, you're more likely to be a Romney supporter.
You might be, or you might be an Obama supporter. You might be a non-enthusiastic Romney supporter, or you might be one of those Democrats who feel that Obama hasn't delivered for them.
Hmm. Interesting.
I think it works both ways.
Yeah. So, and there's no consensus about which way it's going to work.
No, I think this is going to be looked at for political scientists. Now, one thing that could be an advantage to Obama is that a lot of these states on the East Coast are reliably blue states, so if people don't go and vote, it helps them. The other unknown, of course, is how badly the storm is going to impact Ohio, which has early voting, and which is crucial.
Yeah, because this storm is going to end up around Election Day in the Midwest, isn't it?
Yes, it is going to drift over to the Midwest. It's going to hit West Virginia quite hard. The Appalachian Mountains are going to get storm, snow. But how badly it's going to hit Ohio isn't clear. It may just be bad rain. So we don't know that yet. Ohio, again, is an unknown factor.
Wow. And I recall those long lines, and I think it was 2004, where people were standing in the rain for 6, 8, 10 hours in order to vote, mostly in minority neighborhoods, the way that... the governor and the secretary of state had rigged the system, set the system up. Out in the white suburbs, you could vote quite quickly. What else is going on?
Well, the other thing that's going on, the other political thing that's going on, is President Obama trying to regain the edge with women. His campaign says that they have internal polling more accurate and predictive than public polling, which relies on more sophisticated, expensive data, that says that they are well... up. They have a strong double-digit lead among female voters in battleground states like Ohio. So they say, don't believe this story that they're losing women. They say, we're not.
Very, very interesting. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, free-don. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And former Kansas governor, currently Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius is with us. Governor, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be with you. I haven't gotten a chance to chat with you since Charlotte.
It's been a while. And Mitt Romney, I am just astounded by this. Richard Murdoch... and his comments about rape and pregnancy and all this stuff, there seems to be a theme emerging out of the Republican Party here. And Romney is not disavowing this. Am I correct in this?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Richard Murdoch, who's running for the United States Senate from the state of Indiana, made what I think is pretty appalling statement in his debate the other night that suggested that women who... get pregnant as a result of a rape are actually executing the will of God, and suggested that there should be absolutely no exceptions for banning all abortions,
right,
including exceptions for rape and incest. I think the issue with the ties to Mitt Romney are a couple. One is that Mitt Romney cut a TV ad for Richard Murdoch, which just began to run. He has not pulled the ad down. He has not distanced himself from the comments of the candidate. Mitt Romney also chose Paul Ryan as his running mate, and Paul Ryan has co-sponsored legislation in the House of Representatives, which would change the definition of rape to forcible rape, and also has made it very clear that he supports banning all abortions with no exception for rape and incest. And thirdly, the Republican platform, the platform of the party nominating Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, make that same kind of statement. So I think this is a party which has made it very clear that they have, they believe very strongly that women should not make their own health decisions. Women who are victims of violent crime shouldn't even be allowed options, health options, to make decisions about their own recovery. And they keep reiterating that over and over again. And I don't think the majority of the American people support that very extremely conservative point of view.
Would a reasonable way to boil this down into a bumper sticker be to say that the Republican position is that if you are raped, you may not have the morning after pill?
Well, I think that's absolutely true. That is a piece of this position, but I think an even more distressing piece, which again, the vice presidential nominee, Paul Ryan, has supported, is even changing the definition of rape, suggesting that somehow, as Todd Akin said in his debate and as a co-sponsor of Ryan legislation, that some rapes are legitimate and that you would only even be prosecuted on something that was known as forcible rape, whatever that means.
Right.
The president has very clearly said rape is rape. It's a violent crime. It's a crime against women. Not only should there be no change in definition and should the perpetrators be prosecuted to the degree possible in the law, but also women then need to have their own decisions made about how they recover, how they best survive what is a violent crime.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking about Republican women who would, you know, are just kind of voting. Maybe they were raised, you know, Republicans, whatever. They're you know, low information voters. There are many of them of both genders, of course. But Republican leaning women, who may even be, you know, pro-life. But if that simple statement was made, you know, Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney don't even, and Murdoch and all these guys, they don't even want you to have access to the morning after pill if you get raped. That seems to me like a huge threshold. But in any case, the president has published a plan for his second term. What do you know about this? I have not seen it, frankly. I know that it's being passed out. There's several million copies of it out there. I'm trying to get one.
Well, we'll make sure you get
one. Well, thank you very much.
How is this different
from what has happened for the last 4 years?
You bet. So the president actually has been talking about the elements of a new economy, an economy built to last for some period of time, and it's a clear, concrete agenda. It talks about creating jobs, but unlike his opponent, Mitt Romney, he has some specific ways to do that. He wants at least 1 million new manufacturing jobs, and feels that we can do that, among other things, by doubling our exports. If we make more products and goods here in America, like the car industry that he helped to recover from the brink of bankruptcy, then we will be exporting goods around the world, and that's both jobs here and making sure that we sell more products. He also thinks that a part of that export picture is making sure that we don't reward companies who are sending jobs overseas, that we actually change the tax code so that companies have more incentive to keep jobs here at home. So there's a jobs piece and a manufacturing piece. Secondly, an energy policy. And again, you've heard him say this, Tom, where he talks about an all-of-the-above strategy that we want to cut our oil imports in half, produce more American-made energy. And again, we're on track to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But that it can't just be oil and gas and clean coal. It has to also include wind and solar. Again, a very dramatic difference with Mitt Romney, who would get rid of the production tax credit, which has really been very helpful to the wind industry.
Mm-hmm.
And the president would like to get rid of some of the oil credits that have been in place for these companies that are literally making billions of dollars and put some of that money back into the new sources of cleaner energy. But we have an opportunity to create 600,000 jobs in natural gas alone. He also has doubled the fuel efficiency of our cars and trucks so that by 2015 we are going to be driving vehicles which get twice as many miles for a gallon of gas. And when you think about our young men and women who are fighting in the Middle East, among other things, for energy security, the least we can do is be efficient and effective when we use those resources.
Yeah.
He talks about, third, training the best workforce in the world,
mm-hmm.
recruiting more math and science teachers, training at least 2 million additional Americans in community colleges who have job skills, but they may not be the 21st century job skills they need, and cutting the growth of tuition in half over the next decade so that we not only expand student aid, but also make sure that the cost of tuition doesn't just continue to skyrocket. And certainly a piece of this puzzle is reducing our deficit, but doing it in a fair and balanced way, making sure that as we look at his plan to cut the deficit by more than $4 trillion in the next decade, we are really asking the wealthy to pay a little more, but then cutting spending on the other side. So there's a balanced approach to how we get to a deficit reduction package.
Yeah.
And finally, as we bring these troops home, we have, he has, as he promised to do, ended the war in Iraq. We are on track to bring the troops out of Afghanistan, but that we use at least half of those savings to pay down our debt and fix our infrastructure here at home, put people to work, but do it in a way that we end up with better roads, better runways, bridges, rebuild our schools, the kind of infrastructure that will carry us into the 21st century.
Yep, we're moving in the right direction. We need to go farther and faster, and I think Obama will do it. Governor Kathleen Sebelius, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you. Everybody needs to go vote.
Indeed.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, please get out and vote, and get out and vote now. We'll be right back. Friday, what's on your mind today? The sky doesn't look quite like that today, I'll tell you. Rod in Mount Pleasant, Michigan. Hey, Rod, what's up?
Yeah, love your show. Love your show.
Thanks.
Yeah, this is Anything Goes Friday, I understand. So I wanted to get serious with you and ask you a serious question. What kind of shoe does Romney wear? What's his favorite shoe?
Shoe? I don't know. What is it?
Flip-flops, man.
Flip-flops, of course, of course. Okay, thanks a lot, Rod. Good one. Bum-bum. Rodney in Chicago Heights, Illinois. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Hey, Tom. First of all, I hope that yourself, Louise, and the cats, and your house write out Frankenstein.
Yeah, thank you. Me too. We're going to do our best.
I will be saying a prayer for you. But yesterday in the 3 o'clock hour, you had a rant about the Tabor ballot initiatives.
Yeah, these so-called taxpayer bill of rights laws, yeah.
Right. Well, we have something similar here on the ballot in Illinois, and it's a proposed amendment to the state constitution as far as any raises on the state pensions would require a three-fifths majority from both houses for any increases, but there's no language in there as far as reductions.
Right, you can cut a pension with a simple majority.
Right, and I would urge all my fellow Illinoisans to vote no on that ballot initiative. And also, my niece is a grade school teacher for the last 10 years, and a lot of her associates are trying to retire this year if they possibly can behind this ballot initiative.
Yeah, wow. This is sad. We are driving away our good teachers. Rodney, thank you for the call. Just another symptom of what happens when right-wingers take over a country. We're seeing it in Greece. We're seeing it here. In Newport News, Virginia, Jack. Hey, Jack, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Fine.
Love your show.
Thanks.
It's really kind of a question and part of a complaint as well. I'm really tired of the conservative base throwing around the idea of the Constitution and dressing up as patriots to go to their Tea Party rallies when they really seem like the ones that complain about the Constitution or how it works or how it should work kind of know the least about it.
Mm-hmm.
And what kills me is that the Constitution was one of the most progressive radical documents in its time. There's not been anything really like that up until that time. And there was some things like Magna Carta and some other issues in England with, you know, establishing parliament representation. But this was a game changer.
Oh, yeah. And the mention of the general welfare. I mean, that was like shocking. Wait a minute. The general welfare, not just the welfare of the kings and queens?
No, absolutely. And that's what it was designed for, to you know, raise up every man. And at the time, don't get me wrong, they had their problems with how they, you know, viewed themselves and the class of citizens in
sure.
this country. But at the same time, is that if the founding fathers were alive today, the ideas and the principles they found in this country are to watch people that will do anything to get into power, to minimize the vote, to throw away voting ballots, well, you know, for whatever reason. But it's still, I mean, they would be heartbroken
yeah.
to see just exactly how they're trying to hijack the very principles that they sit there and beat their chest about every day.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes me sick.
Yep. I think, you know, very well said, Jack. Thanks a lot for the call. I can't find anything to disagree with on that or to add to that. Jay in Fort Washington, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jay, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. Actually, my name is Jerry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Tom, I just have a quick comment and a question for you. The quick comment is I've been referring to Romney's party lately as the Resmuglicans. And they seem to fit the bill for that.
Resmuglicans.
But I wanted to make a more serious comment, if I can, that I'm wondering about. I saw Greg Palast's piece about Delphi and what was going on with Delco and Bain Capital buying out that and then sort of extorting money from GM.
Right.
And it made me wonder when Romney was writing the editorial about GM and saying just let them go under, it made me wonder whether he might have had designs on them for Bain Capital.
It's entirely possible.
Could buy GM for pennies on the dollar?
It's entirely possible, of course. Yeah. I don't know if Bain was floating loans at that time, but his suggestion was that somebody would run them through a managed bankruptcy, that they would be that the loans would be government guaranteed, but somebody was going to have to come up with the loans. And the reason that the president said, no, we're going to let the government come up with the loans is because at that point in time, the banking system was frozen up. Now, it may well have
right.
been that in the private equity system that, you know, some of these pirate equity guys had plenty of money, and Bain Capital might have been one of them. I don't know that. You know, it's going to have to lay in the realm of speculation, Jay, but
I believe it's true.
Yeah, I can't discount it or dispute it. Jay, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew in Syracuse, New York. We got a minute to the break. Andrew, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. You have mentioned that 50% of personal bankruptcies are due to inability to pay medical bills.
That's correct.
I happen to be a lawyer, and I do bankruptcy work. I wanted to mention that there are some hidden costs there. When medical bills don't get paid, the medical providers, such as the hospitals, have to either absorb that cost or pass it along to those who do pay, meaning the insurance companies, and they have to either absorb the loss or pass it along to people who pay. So for the Tea Party people who say, I don't want to pay for somebody else's medical expenses, well, they're doing it already. We're all doing it, except not in a very efficient manner.
Yeah, yeah.
There's another aspect, though, that's hidden, and that is that when somebody files for bankruptcy, they put all of their debts in the bankruptcy, including things like credit card debts.
Right.
So that means that, take a big bank, Citibank, Bank of America, somebody like that, they've got thousands of people who are filing for bankruptcy, maybe that's caused by the medical bills,
right.
But they drag the credit card debt along with that.
Yes.
So if,
excellent point. So if we fix our healthcare system, we reduce the number of bankruptcies, and that helps the entire economy. Excellent point, Andrew. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm telling you, we've got the smartest listeners in all of radio and television. I learn something every day. Thank you. We'll be right back.
I need a big weekend.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Jason in Bradley, Illinois. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I listened to you second hour about your point where the Social Security card would suffice for somebody wanting to vote in this country.
All right. Well, no, it wasn't so much that the Social Security card would, but what I was saying is we've got this bizarre, antiquated, and I realize, you know, states' rights, the individual states, you know, figure out how they're going to vote, and that's in the Constitution, and probably you're not going to do much about it. But states could individually choose to simply say if somebody has a Social Security number, then they are registered to vote. Why would that not be a problem? Why would that be a problem?
Well, the only thing is anytime a woman changes her name when she gets married, she gets issued a new Social Security card.
Not true. That's not true. I know that that's not true because, you know, my wife's Social Security number was the same before we got married and after we got married, and she changed her name to Hartman.
Yes, but you need to make sure that the states would then confiscate the old Social Security card.
No, there's no difference in the number. It's just a name change.
Yes, but did they take her old card when she got the new card with her new name on it?
Oh, I'm not even sure, you know, I don't know. Oh, I see what you're saying, that the card, the name on the card would not match the number any longer. Yeah,
yes,
yeah. Of course, they issue a notice. Yes, well, you do a name change. You file for a name change. You file for it with Social Security. You file for it with the Driver's License Bureau. You file for it with whoever you have to do it with. I mean, it's been well over 30 years since Louise and I got married, and so I don't remember all the details of it, but, you know, we certainly did that.
As long as there aren't other Social Security cards floating out there and anyone you wrote a check to could therefore know what your signature looks like,
yeah,
know where you live, and duplicate it on election day.
Here's the problem with that kind of thinking, Jason. There are so few people in America, in fact, I would say virtually none, who think that it's worth going to jail for 2 years to illegally vote, to do all that work to be one illegal vote. Who's going to do that?
Exactly. The only problem is that the wife not then vote twice.
No, there is no the only problem, because then she could go to jail for two, three, four years, depending on the state. This is like saying, we need to photograph and fingerprint people before they walk into stores because there's a problem with shoplifting. Well, at least with shoplifting, when you walk out of the store, you may have something of value. It's one of the reasons why stores tend to lock up the really expensive stuff and make it really, you know, and they've got these blister packs where it's really hard to break things out of them so you can stick them in your pocket and walk out. I mean, stores have figured out ways to try and stop shoplifting, but the bottom line is at least you have something of value. If you vote, what do you have of value? Nothing. There's no incentive for voter fraud. The voter fraud is something that Jason, if you believe this myth, you have been listening to a fraud that was created by a group of billionaires and right wing politicians who have one single understanding. Paul Weyrich laid it out 32 years ago. when he was in Dallas, Texas, talking to a group, and this is the guy who was the co-founder of the American Legislative Exchange Council, which wrote the bills that were passed in most of these states where they've got the voter suppression ID laws. And this is the guy who helped run the direct mail campaign for the Ronald Reagan candidacy, which, by the way, helped Ronald Reagan become president. And he also worked on the George Herbert Walker Bush campaign, and he also worked on the George W. Bush campaign. This is the one of the co-founders of the Heritage Foundation, the godfather of the modern conservative movement. Paul Weyrich had this to say back in 1980, talking to a group of Christian Republicans in a church in Dallas, Texas.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome, good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
So, if you don't want everybody to vote, if you want to reduce the number of people who are voting, how do you do that? Well, it used to be that, you know, with a wink and a nod, white people, this is during Reconstruction, you know, after the Civil War, there were a lot of white people, particularly in the South, who didn't want African Americans voting. But they couldn't just come out and say that. I mean, frequently they did, but it wasn't in polite company, so acceptable. So they said, it's not that we don't want black people voting, but, these people used to be slaves. They didn't learn how to read and write. They're not well educated. And this is the first generation after slavery. So let's make sure that everybody who votes at least understands the issues. And so let's have a literacy test. As if people, you know, who are not super literate don't understand. You see, it was just an excuse. Just a plain old flat-out excuse. And frankly, it was being done at that point in time. Literacy tests were being pushed by the Democratic Party, which had been the party of slavery in the 19th century, and were being resisted by the Republican Party. Things have changed, have they not? Largely since Richard Nixon's Southern strategy. But the bottom line is that, you know, for a long time in America, the strategy has not been let's have fair and open elections and a clean discussion of the topics. It's been let's rig the electorate. So in 2012, if you want to rig the electorate, if you want to suppress the number of people who are going to vote for Democrats, understanding that when you look at the African-American population, for example, as a consequence of 400 years of slavery and 100 years of legal apartheid and just a couple of generations of coming out of that and starting to build a black middle class where average household wealth in the United States, the average white family in the United States, average household wealth, $87,000, most of it's home equity. Average African-American family wealth in the United States, $5,000. I mean, this is the foundation of white privilege that people are born into. So, therefore, African-American families are less likely to own a car. They're more likely to live in urban areas where you don't need a car. You can use public transportation. Take the bus, take the subway, take the metro. Louise and I moved here to Washington, D.C. 2 years ago. We sold our car in Portland. We haven't owned a car in 2 years. If it's an emergency, I take a cab. Otherwise, I take the metro or I walk, as do most people in the city, white and black. And what you find is people in big cities tend not to own cars. So you don't own a car, you don't have a driver's license. If you've never owned a car, I mean, if you were born and grew up in that city, 25% of the African-American population of the United States doesn't have photo ID. You say, well, you got to have photo ID to get on an airplane. They're not getting on airplanes. And the number, the percentage of Americans who fly on airplanes is well under a quarter of Americans who fly, once a year or more on airplanes. It's a very small slice of people who fly very frequently. That's why they have frequent flyer programs. So you look at that. You look at the Hispanic population in the United States. 19-20% of them don't have photo ID. You look at people who are retired. They're on Social Security, Medicare. 15-25%, depending on what state you're looking at, they don't have photo IDs. Why? Because they don't drive anymore. They're 80 years old. They don't even go out of the house anymore. Young people between 18 and 24, used to be a lot of them had driver's licenses. Oh, boy, I'm 16. Let me get my driver's license. No, not so much. Oddly enough, almost 20% of them don't have photo IDs. Or if they do, it's a student ID. And a lot of these state laws say, yeah, student ID, not good enough. Sorry. So if you're a Republican and you're trying to figure out a way to suppress the vote, how do you do it? Well, you look, and then among white people, it's 8%. 8% of white people don't have photo ID. So you look at those numbers and you say, you know, these minorities, they're voting Democratic. Old people are on Social Security. The Democratic Party brought us Social Security. They're voting Democratic. The Democratic Party brought us Medicare, Medicaid, Medicare for elderly people. They're voting. The old people are voting Democratic. The working poor tends, which, you know, disproportionately people of color are in the category of the working poor. The working poor, because they're working, but they're poor, their kids get free lunches at school or they qualify for food stamps. And these are programs that have been brought to you by the Democratic Party and fought every tooth and nail, every step of the way by the Republican Party. And they know it. And students, you know, 20 years ago in the United States, 80% of the cost of of college tuition was paid for by federal, state, and local governments. 80%. Tuition covered 20% of the cost of an education. Just 20 years ago. Today, 30% of the cost of an education, of college tuition, is covered by federal, state, or local governments. 70% is paid for by the students. You wonder why the cost of education has gone up so much? It's got nothing to do with, you know, college professors being paid too much. It has to do with crashing the federal and state benefits for education. You know, the idea, the dream that Thomas Jefferson had, that anybody who could qualify for college should be able to get a full education all the way up to PhD for free. That dream that Thomas Jefferson had when he created the University of Virginia, the dream that Abraham Lincoln had when he created the land-grant colleges, the Republicans have destroyed that. And young people, students, they know it. They get it. The Republicans are opponents of free college education, and the Democrats are proponents, are in favor of it. So how do you keep those people from voting who would vote Democratic for those reasons? Well, if you notice that a lot of them don't have photo IDs, you start talking about voter fraud. Oh, there are people who want to vote twice. There are even though there's laws against this, you go to prison. Nobody's going to go to prison for a vote.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It is so absurd as to be... I mean, it's like only stupid people, if they really seriously thought about it, would believe this voter fraud myth.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producer, Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to writer-researcher Sam Sachs, to Alva Goldbrook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to everyone at the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on commercial stations, Pacifica Radio on non-commercial stations, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, to all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. It really is appreciated when you call into your local radio station and say, you know, thank you for the program, and I am going to pay attention to the advertiser. You call a sponsor or advertiser and say, hey, I heard you on the Tom Hartman program, and even if I'm not going to buy your product right now, I'm going to tell other people about it. You'd be surprised how rare those calls happen and how much impact they have and how much they are appreciated, I'll tell you. Valerie in Herman, Nebraska. Hey, Valerie, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just discovered this free speech about a month ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's great. I just, we live in a red state, and can you explain what good it would do for a person to vote Democratic?
Yeah. Yeah, the first of all, you know, in the 2000 election, Al Gore got 500,000 more votes than George W. Bush. That's a blot, a stain on America, that the guy who got the most votes wasn't president. And the more often those kinds of things happen, the more it encourages us to say, you know, maybe we should change things. I think that there's frankly a movement building, and you see it among the third party candidates more than the primary two party candidates. But there's a strong movement. There are more people registered right now in the United States as independents than as Democrats or Republicans. And I think that that's because people are saying, let's open the system up a little bit. So if, for example, Romney were to win the Electoral College, but Obama won the national vote, as happened in 2000, although in 2000, really, it was the Supreme Court that decided the case. It was, you know, but don't get me started. But if that were to happen, I think that that sends a message. Again, it amplifies the message that our electoral system is screwed up. So, yeah, I think every vote counts regardless of whether you're in a reliably red or a reliably blue state. Every vote counts. Not only that, you've got local races. It's not, I mean, the president is not the only issue. You've got senators. You've got members of Congress. You've got county things, you've got judges, you've got ballot initiatives. I mean, voting, I realize that there's a real serious attempt by the Republican Party, which includes having people call into talk radio and say, I'm a little disappointed with the president, so I think I'm going to vote green. Or, you know, I don't think my vote is going to count. So, you know, trying to encourage people not to vote. I get that. I'm well aware of that. And I understand that there are also some people who are just so, uninformed about the blood price that has been paid over the last 230 years so that you have the right to vote, that they don't take it seriously, which I think is tragic. But the fact of the matter is that this is like the old Oliver Wendell Holmes, taxes are the price of entrance to a civil society. Voting is the price of admission to a democracy. If you want to be a member of this democracy, if you want to be part of our democracy, then vote, period, wherever you are. And vote your heart. Vote what you think is best. I'm not telling you how to vote. But I am saying, no matter what state you live in, no matter where you live, there are important things on that ballot, and you need to be participating with it. So, let's see here. Richard in Monclova, Ohio. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Hey, I just wanted to let you know how glad I am to see you up and feeling better.
Oh, thank you. Me too.
I've been in a hospital bed myself, not knowing whether I would get out or not. And I'm just delighted we can be here and have this conversation.
Thank you. Me too.
All right. I wanted to comment about how disappointed I was about the debate on foreign policy and how, you know, issues of free trade and how they have had a disastrous effect, not only on jobs in this country, but especially on the lives of poor people in third world countries.
Right.
And also the devastating effects they've had on the environment. Until somebody really starts addressing these issues, to me, the election, the presidential election is about who can beat Casey Jones on this trade.
I know. And really, the debate on foreign policy wasn't a debate on foreign policy. It was a debate on the Middle East.
Who can be Israel's best friend.
Yeah, that's my point. But the, among other things. But the Richard, you raise a really, and by the way, Shano says that you are the guy who is going to get a copy of Cracking the Code, the book I wrote on political communication. It's one of my favorite books because it actually explains in detail the origin of the mindset of liberal and conservative thinking. So it's called Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, and brought to you by Stamps.com. So, Richard, thank you for the call. And we will be sending you that autographed copy of Cracking the Code in a few minutes. But anyhow, the point that I wanted to make, which I've kind of run out of time for, we'll pick it up tomorrow. We'll pick it up tomorrow. Coming up, or Monday rather, remember reading about feudal lords in your high school history books? Well, guess what? They're back! A new bill about to come to law in Pennsylvania would require workers to pay taxes to their bosses for the privilege of having a job. I'm not making this up. I'm going to be challenging conservative Peter Farrar of the Carlson Center for Public Policy on this one. Plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for we the people. And don't forget, democracy requires your participation. Yes, get out there and vote. Get out there, get active. Get out there, occupy something, tag. You're it. See you tomorrow. Or see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.